Together we will stand, fight until fall. Come on now, people, let's get on the ball and work together. Come on, let's work together.
Do it, children.
Now, now, people, say now, together we will stand. Every boy, girl, woman, and man. Oh, yeah.
Good morning and welcome to Neighbors on KUMD. It's a new program that we're bringing you at 10 o'clock on Tuesdays and Thursdays to have a conversation about these times in which we're living. Talk to folks that can maybe help shed some insight onto the things that we're seeing. Talk about our challenges. Talk about our triumphs a little bit. Lots of stuff in the news over the past week. And so my first note to self, I guess, is stay off of social media because I just read things that really trouble me. There is an article in Forbes magazine that has not drawn a lot of attention, and I have to confess, as a journalist, that kind of surprises me. It has laid out in great and kind of complicated detail how they have been able to discover that a lot of these back-to-work anti-lockdown protests are being stage managed. They are being kind of falsely creative. People are puppets and somebody is pulling the strings. To talk about that with us a little bit this morning is Dr. Jeremy Ude. He's been our guest before. He's a global health politics and policy researcher and a professor here at UMD. Hey, Jeremy, good morning.
Hey, thanks so much for having me again, Lisa.
Nice to have you on the line. So, again, this Forbes article laid out in technical detail how they were able to tell that basically this whole protest, a lot of it is being orchestrated and stage managed. And I would like to think that anyone, regardless of your political leaning, would be terrified by that prospect. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Sure. So the article talks about this idea of these groups doing what they call astroturfing. So if we think about a lot of protest movements, you know, we talk about grassroots movements. Things are coming up naturally because people are sharing a concern. They're getting involved with their other members of their community, and they're working together. So it's kind of coming from the grassroots. This idea of astroturfing is that someone else is basically coming in and ginning up these sorts of systems. So in the same way that AstroTurf is fake grass, that you've got these fake groups that are popping up where you've got someone who is using something to try to manipulate public opinion or to get other groups to glom on to issues. And so that's a lot of what we see in this article that came out in Forbes, this idea that people who are not really all that interested or concerned so much about coronavirus per se are using other sorts of issues around guns, around other sorts of identity issues, and glomming onto these concerns about coronavirus as a way of trying to gin up greater concern and then make it look like this movement is even bigger than it actually is.
It was interesting after, I don't think it was last weekend, I want to say it was the weekend before, where there were a lot of protests, a lot of people, including in our area, and people had the option to see on the evening news these different protests popping up everywhere. And then the numbers came out that national polls are indicating most people want the lockdowns, the stay-at-home orders to stay in place. They want everybody to continue to stay at home.
Yeah. I mean, if we look at the public opinion polling, it's absolutely in line with that. So this idea that most people are feeling like it's not, we're not at a point where it is safe to reopen businesses or to go back to normal life. And that gets to this whole issue around reopening and changing some of these shelter in place orders. It's one thing to change the laws to say, okay, businesses can reopen, or we're going to allow for for restaurants to allow for table service. It's another thing about whether people actually feel comfortable doing that, because if people don't feel comfortable doing that, all the laws on the books aren't going to make a difference. It's about whether people feel like, am I going to be safe? Can I keep myself safe, my family safe, my community safe if I'm going out and engaging in these sorts of activities? And that's really where this disconnect is popping up.
Jeremy, earlier this week, I asked Dr. David Beard a question that I continue to struggle with. If you take the idea that you are a nice person who is compassionate to people, it's hard to know, is the kind thing to make people stay in lockdown where they will be safe for the virus, or is the kind thing to allow people to go back to work, in which case they can earn money to feed their families, pay their bills? And I was thinking too about the meat packing workers that have, you know, in essence been ordered to go back, and yet the appropriate protections have been kind of like, oh yeah, somebody will do that. I mean, that'll get taken care of, but you need to go back to work, when these meat packing plants are kind of these hotspots of coronavirus. So as you watch the events unfolding, assuming you think of yourself as a nice person, how do you start unpacking this? How do you start balancing all of these different and competing interests as you're trying to understand what's going on?
Yeah, and this is really where we need to understand that, you know, when we're looking at some of the response to something like coronavirus, this is not just a public health issue. It obviously is a public health issue on one front, but if we are telling people that they're not going to be able to go to work, there are going to be limitations on that, we also have to think about the implications that go along with that in terms of people's ability to have an income, to take care of their families, to make sure that they have access to healthcare if they need it, that they can go to see the doctor. And you know, that gets really tricky, especially in a country like the U.S., where so much of our insurance is based on our employment status. And so these are very real trade-offs that people are being forced to make. And it's not just about these sorts of public health recommendations. It gets to the broader public policy concerns that we have, and just sort of our basic notion of what a social safety net looks like and why we have a social safety net.
With that in mind, there is new information out today that the administration would still like to get rid of the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act, of course, has nobody's ever necessarily jumped up and down and said this is a beautiful, perfect thing in its final form. I think everybody has acknowledged all across the board that this was, you know, kind of a first draft. It needs a lot of work, but would that make sense to do something like that at this point? Why would that be under consideration in the middle of a pandemic where even people who don't understand the details kind of go, huh?
Yeah, I mean, it fits along from an ideological perspective. You know, the idea that the administration wants to get rid of the Affordable Care Act. This is something that the Trump administration has talked about since Trump was first running for the presidency, and a number of the other leader Republicans have also argued for this position. So in that respect, it makes some sense from an ideological position. But, you know, in the midst of a time when we're seeing more and more how crucial it is to have a robust healthcare system, and that people have access to that healthcare system, and the difference in people's access to the healthcare system has a very direct effect on their ability to get sick, their ability to get well, their ability to take care of their families. This just seems like the absolute wrong time to do it. And, you know, in the same way when we've seen the efforts to try to freeze the funding for the World Health Organization. Now, in the midst of the crisis, you don't want to further weaken those institutions that are there to try to provide us with some protection and try to make sure that people don't fall even further behind.
The administration has been leery of a lot of additional global health organizations, too. I see your point about timing. If we weren't in the middle of a global pandemic, do some of those ideas make sense? Is it just a question of the idea of defunding some of these things? It's bad timing because of the pandemic, but it would be a good idea otherwise? Or is it just kind of a bad idea across the board? I'm curious.
Yeah, I would call it a bad idea across the board. And you know, part of what makes it challenging is that when you're doing it in the midst of a pandemic, I mean, you know, when there are always times to reevaluate any of these sorts of institutions, be it the Affordable Care Act, be it the World Health Organization. And none of these sorts of institutions, and I'm using that in the very broad sense of the term, none of those are perfect institutions. And there are always opportunities to reform those institutions, to change them, to try to improve upon them. But at a time when we're seeing those institutions being the most necessary, when people are most reliant upon them, the idea that you are either going to be able to radically restructure them in the midst of what of the time that you are completely trying to rely on them, or you're going to take away the funding from them so that you make them even less available, it's an irresponsible time to do it. You know, it's the same. You could think about it as if you are flying a plane, while you're flying the plane, you're not going to try to turn it into a fighter jet, or you're not going to try to add another set of wings or do something like that. You wait until you land and have some time to actually do that sort of evaluation. So there are times and places to do those sorts of things and to do those investigations. But right now, we need to recognize the importance of these institutions for people's lives, frankly.
Could you talk a little bit about the World Health Organization and what it does? I don't think that in our day-to-day lives, many of us think much about the World Health Organization, or its work is not really brought to our attention. So I think many people don't even know what it's about and what it does.
Yeah. So the World Health Organization has been around since 1948. It's one of the specialized agencies of the United Nations. Has 194 member states, and its job, its constitutional mandate is to act as this international coordinator of cross-border health action. So it's not there to implement policy. It can't force a country to take any sort of particular policy. It doesn't have a huge staff, so it can't go out and actually provide a lot of direct services to countries or to individuals. But what it can do is it can help to bring countries together. It can provide this resource of information, of data, and looking at best practices for various health sorts of issues. So it's been really active in things like the polio eradication campaign or vaccination campaigns, or helping low and middle income countries to think about how can they structure their healthcare systems to improve access for people who might be living outside of urban areas. And so on a day-to-day basis, a lot of its work is really behind the scenes. It's not the sort of agency that you're going to see on a day-to-day basis. It does have a big role when we have these sorts of pandemics, though. So when the Ebola outbreak was happening in West Africa in 2014 through 2016, the World Health Organization was taking the lead on a lot of that. When SARS was happening in 2002 and 2003, the World Health Organization was taking a lot of responsibility and a lot of action on that. But in terms of its overall budget and its mandate, it's got a relatively small budget, but it's got a really big mandate to try to help coordinate all of these sorts of activities. And the United States is the largest contributor to the World Health Organization. So by freezing the funding for the organization that already has a pretty limited budget, that just puts a further squeeze on what the organization is able to do at a time when they have declared this COVID-19 outbreak to be a public health emergency of international concern. And that's kind of like the most pressing issue. That's the bat signal, if you will, that the World Health Organization can send out to the world saying, hey, this is something that we need to pay attention to. This is something that we need to collaborate on.
There are concerns. I've heard people talk about being concerned that America is perhaps unfairly expected to assume more of a financial burden for some of these things. In your opinion, as someone who understands this, certainly better than I, do you think that's the case?
I mean, the United States has played an incredibly important role in the global health system in general, and it has been the largest single contributor to global health development assistance for a number of years. So it has definitely played a big role. And one of the things that is a challenge right now is that we're losing that leadership. one of the things that goes along with the United States' role in global health is not just the financial resources, but also the leadership roles, helping to coordinate activities, helping to bring countries together, and helping to share information amongst countries so we can all be on the same page, if you will. And by losing that, we end up in a situation where it's harder to have that sort of coordination happening. It's harder to work together, to collaborate, because this is exactly the sort of issue that you need collaboration. No country is going to be able to take care of COVID-19 on its own. Even if we were to stop all the cases that were happening within the United States, there are still cases happening in other countries. The United States is still at risk. And so there needs to be some sort of cooperation there. Now, whether or not the balance is appropriate in terms of who's doing the funding and how they are funding something like the World Health Organization itself, the member states are the ones who have the ability to make those decisions and can reallocate how those funding decisions are being made. But there hasn't been an interest or a willingness amongst the member states to have those sorts of conversations, to look at how they want to restructure things. There was a call to do that in the aftermath of the Ebola outbreak, and the member states, the United States included, said, no, we don't really want to change the structures that exist. So it's up to the member states to have those sorts of decisions. And so and the United States could play a very important role in saying, hey, let's have a conversation around how we are funding these global health initiatives. But that depends on the member states taking that sort of action.
As you talk about the importance of coordinated effort, and I think that is something that we as folks are at home, they have an awful lot of time to consume news media, they have an awful lot of time to have conversations with one another over social media about some of these issues. One of the things that you mentioned in a text message to me was that some other countries that are not struggling with the partisan divide that the United States is have been able to be a lot more effective in their response to COVID-19. Talk about that a little bit.
Sure. So there was an article that came out just a few days ago that was in Vox that was comparing the responses to COVID-19 in the United States and in Canada. And one of the things that they were looking at was the effectiveness of the response and seeing that Canada had had a far more aggressive and far more robust response to the outbreak. And one of the things that they had found is looking at public opinion polls, that it was that people's responses to the government actions were not tracking based on their partisan alliance. So, you know, we have very strong parties in the Canadian Parliament. The parties obviously do not necessarily care for one another. They campaign against one another on a frequent basis, but that people weren't seeing the government as their actions being motivated by their partisan allegiances. We could also look at something like Australia and New Zealand, both of which have gotten really high marks for their responses. They have very different governments in terms of being more conservative in Australia and more liberal in New Zealand. But again, the response was seen as being above politics, that the political officials, the government officials were relying on these nonpartisan experts that were coming from the public health and scientific communities to generate their policy recommendations. They were communicating that clearly. They were all coming together, the political officials and the scientific officials, to speak with one voice. And they were able to present this information in a way that people trusted what the government was doing. They weren't questioning the motivations behind why they were making certain sorts of decisions. And so if we compare that to what we're seeing in the United States, there's very much a partisan divide in terms of how people are responding to how they're responding to the outbreak and the various restrictions that have been put in place, but also we've seen these disagreements amongst policymakers or between policymakers and public health officials about the sorts of policies that should be implemented in these sorts of matters, and that weakens our ability to have a really robust response, because you need that communication, you need that trust, and if these things are being attached to partisan positions, it's much harder to do that sort of thing.
I am going to, with that in just a moment, I'm going to circle back around to this astroturfing concept that we talked about at the beginning. But first, I want to ask you, it has appeared to me in Minnesota, at any rate, just in our little corner of the state, I've got a bunch of friends across different spectrums. I have not heard anything really negative about Minnesota Governor Tim Walz and his handling of the pandemic. And it may have been actually you that pointed out, or another one of the smart guests that we've had on recently, that pointed out that his transparency about the process, where he's getting the numbers from, what the numbers are, the way that that is being interpreted, and his kind of walking people through his process to get to where he's gotten, that people seem to be willing to accept that and feel as though, I may not like it, but this seems to make common sense. Is that kind of the sort of thing that we're seeing, at least here in our state, that kind of, this isn't about politics, this is about doing the smartest thing in this situation?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at what's happening across the country, a lot of governors are getting really good marks for their response to COVID-19. And it's precisely because of this. It's because, and this is something that's crossing partisan divide. So you've got, a DFL governor like Governor Walz, but then you've also got Republican governors like Larry Hogan out in Maryland. And when they're able to do that very data-driven, that very fact-based sort of response, and that they are walking people through the how they're making their decisions. Here's the data that I'm using. Here's why I'm making these decisions. Here's showing some compassion for understanding the challenges they're asking people to make, that actually has a really big effect. And we're seeing a lot of respect for people giving a lot of respect and a lot of props to their to governors that they're not necessarily giving to the national response. Now, all that said, we are starting to see a little bit of a fractioning here in Minnesota. If you look at what's been happening with the state Senate and the talk around the bonding bills. This is a bonding year for the Minnesota legislature. So things like building new buildings on the University of Minnesota campuses, so including UMD, that's something that would go through the bonding process. And the state Senate, which is controlled by the Republicans, has said, we're not willing to look at these bonding measures until the governor rescinds some of the emergency powers that he is using to make some of these stay-at-home orders in place. So we're seeing a little bit of that happening within the legislature itself. But in terms of just the broad public opinion, there is pretty strong support for what the governor is doing. And that's something that we're seeing in a lot of states, because you do have that nice coordination between political officials and public health officials. And you've got that very transparent sort of process.
Again, as we talked in at the very beginning of the show, we talked about this astroturfing. We talked about the idea that different groups are going in, they're fabricating data, they're fabricating angst, they're fabricating news stories, they're trying to stir up dissent, they're trying to take COVID-19 and weaponize the crisis to accomplish their own ends. And I do truly believe in my heart that even though I have friends across the spectrum, that nobody is interested in being manipulated. Nobody's interested in being jerked around. Nobody is interested in their cause or their beliefs being manipulated by somebody to try to trick Americans into believing something that isn't true. I would never, of course, have known this, but a lot of people wouldn't have known this, had Forbes not done that story, written the article, laid it all out. What can we as consumers of news do to try to how do we fight back against this? What can we do?
Yeah, it's such a tricky thing because it is so pervasive, and especially when you're looking at what's happening in social media and trying to get a sense of where some of this information is coming from. One thing is being willing to step away from social media. As you pointed out, a lot of us have our extra time on our hands, or the way that we would normally be spending our time is different, and social media can fill a lot of that. Social media can be great in a lot of respects, but it can also foment these sorts of attitudes or create these sorts echo chambers. So it's good to be able to step away from that. And this is also where it's important to try to have a robust array of different media sources that you're using, and trying to triangulate this information. If you're seeing it from one source, are you able to find this in other places as well? Are you seeing this happening in other places, or is it only coming from one particular source or one particular angle? And just having that opportunity to try to investigate things, if things seem It's that same sort of thing when you're out shopping for a car. You know, if it seems too good to be true, it might be too good to be true. So you want to always have a little bit of a dose of skepticism about these sorts of things. But the broader you can have for your media diet, the better that you're probably going to be able to identify when those sorts of issues are popping up, and that there's something else there might be some other motivation that's going into some of these announcements or some of these purported grassroots movements.
I think it's a sad state of affairs, but I think I feel like I'm being cynical, and yet when I take in news, maybe not always as consistently as I need to, I do try to ask, who is benefiting from this? Who's getting, who stands to gain something from this? And sometimes that can kind of steer you in the right direction in terms of a little bit of skepticism. The other thing I think I've found that is helpful is when people post stories. One of my very favorite memes is the person sitting at the computer late at night, and the partner comes in and says, "What are you doing?" And the person at the computer says, "Somebody got something wrong on the internet." is to go and look at the page where the story originated, go down to the About section, and see what it says about this webpage, this organization, mm-hmm. because many organizations say flat out, what their bias is, what their viewpoint is, what their standpoint is, so that you realize that this is something that is indeed biased, or at least, bias seems pejorative, that they have an idea, this is the place where they're coming from. That's a useful place, and of course there are, you can check facts and you can sometimes check, but you couldn't, for example, you couldn't take this story and put it into Snopes, and Snopes isn't going to go, "Nope, it was computer bots and these people that are doing that." So It's hard to know how to sometimes do the extra step for fact checking.
Yeah, and with the Forbes article, they talk about the process they used to identify the fact that all of these different websites were essentially coming from this very small group of individuals, and they were being put out there to make it look like this was this broad grassroots movement. There's also just have I heard of this organization before? Have I heard of this news site before? And there are always new places that they're popping up. So the fact that something's new doesn't in and of itself mean that it's something that should raise your eyebrows. But if you've never really heard of this before, you don't hear your friends talking about this source or anything like that, that should also raise a few red flags. Like I've never heard of the Minneapolis Daily Star or something like that. That might be a sign that, maybe something else is going on here. Maybe this isn't quite as legitimate.
Jeremy, we're almost out of time, but I'm going to ask you one final question. The fairness doctrine that said that if you're going to run a story about the importance of being in lockdown, you need to run a story about the importance of going back to work, for example. The Fairness Doctrine was repealed in 87? I should know that.
Sometime around there, yeah. 86, 87, 88, sometime that range.
Do you think that listen to me being cynical. Do you think that there is too much money at stake to ever be able to mount a demand for the reinstatement of the Fairness Doctrine?
Oh, that That would definitely be an uphill fight, and it would be an uphill fight in terms of the finances, but also just because of the way that the nature of the media landscape has changed in response to what's happened over these past, 35-ish or so years. It would be a very difficult thing to do, but that doesn't mean that there couldn't potentially be opportunities for looking at, are there other ways of structuring this sort of thing, or other ways to try to make sure that the people are getting as robust a debate and a conversation around these very pressing issues as possible.
Jeremy, thank you so very, very much for joining us. I so appreciate your willingness to take some time and share your expertise with us. It's always a fascinating conversation when you're our guest. Thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for the invitation.
Dr. Jeremy Ude is a global health politics and policy researcher and a professor here at UMD, and he joined us this morning as our guest on Neighbors.